Thank you. I told a group in Trigo 2 weeks ago that I was so amazed by some of the positive comments that I had received from my former political opponents after I had announced my retirement, that I was hiring Brett Favre to serve as a consultant to reconsider. I was really amazed because I was amazed at the newspaper coverage in some papers, why they even wrote stories telling people about things I'd done for the district that they hadn't even written at the time that I did them. It was sort of like reading your obituary when you were still alive. So, but after 48 years, this is the last time I will speak at a Democratic convention. The Democratic Party has been my family almost as much as my own flesh and blood. I grew up in Wisconsin that was a one-party state, the wrong party. In the 50s, Republicans controlled both U.S. Senate seats, the governorship, overwhelming majorities in the Assembly and State Senate. Out of 10 House seats, Democrats held three, Clem Zablocki, Henry Royce, and for a short time, Lester Johnson. The first convention that I attended was in 1959 or 1960. I was a junior at the University of Wisconsin. We just experienced an historic breakthrough in 1957 when Bill Proxmire was elected to Joe McCarthy's Senate seat. Gaylord Nelson had just been elected governor in 58, and Bob Kastenmeier had been elected that same year in the House. And at last, we had a two-party state, because leaders who had been active in the La Follette Progressive Party, when it disbanded, moved into the Democratic Party and rebuilt it from the bottom up. Those were the days when politics was fun, having just emerged from the dark days of Joe McCarthy. And convention headliners in those days were people like Adlai Stevenson, Hubert Humphrey, and John Kennedy. The stars, you bet. The stars of the party were Proxmire, Gaylord Nelson, Kastenmeier, Zablocki and Royce, Pat Lucy, Dave Carley, Filio Nash, John Reynolds. And in the legislature, Fred Risser, Dick Zaborski, Carl Thompson, George Molinaro, Bob Huber, Frank Nicolay, Harvey Duhom. As a college kid, for me, to know these people was thrilling. It was hot stuff. 3 years later, in 1962, I was elected to the legislature myself. And for the first time, I saw close up how a political party could use zealous obstruction to bring down an administration. You see, in 1962, Gaylord was running for the U.S. Senate, and John Reynolds was running for governor. The GOP was universally expected to win that election. But the same thing happened in 1962 that will happen in 2010. The Democrats won. Republican leaders were furious, and they never recognized Reynolds' legitimacy. From day one, the Republican majority belittled and obstructed almost every Reynolds initiative. Sound familiar today? That was my political baptism. After that came a cascade of huge events. The Kennedy assassination, LBJ's landslide in 64, federal aid to education, Medicare, Vietnam, the assassination of Bobby and Martin, Nixon's election in 1968. I was elected to Congress on April Fool's Day of 1969. It could not have happened on any other day. That was followed by Watergate, impeachment, the Clean Air and Water Act, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, the Iranian hostage crisis, the irresponsible Reagan budgets that exploded deficits, the illegal war in Nicaragua, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain, the transformation of Eastern Europe from centrally run Marxist economies to market-oriented democracies, the Clinton administration's restoration of budget surpluses, George Bush's reckless budget-busting reversal of those same Clinton policies, his two rich men's tax cuts paid for with borrowed money, two wars paid for with borrowed money, reckless deregulation of big business, oil and gas, banks, and Wall Street that necessitated the Bush-Wall Street bailout. Finally, after all of that, Barack Obama was elected, inheriting the biggest damned economic mess in 70 years. Facing a huge collapse of consumer purchasing power, the President and Congress stepped up and took action by passing the Economic Recovery Act. Now Republican critics have claimed that it produced no jobs. That is blatant nonsense. And they've said, oh, it costs too much. We cannot afford the deficit spending it creates. Give me a break. We get that same criticism from the very same people who wiped out Bill Clinton's surpluses, produced tax, war, and economic policies that will run up $9 trillion in debt over the next decade, and yet they oppose spending one-tenth that amount in the short term in order to rebuild job opportunities. Like Herbert Hoover in the 30s, and unfortunately some Democrats today, the Republican leadership has never learned the lesson of the Great Depression, which is that when the private economy collapses, if the government does not reinflate the economy by running temporary, and I emphasize temporary, deficits, you delay economic recovery, you delay the day when you can bring long-term deficits down, because unemployment turns productive taxpayers into tax eaters. Their need for unemployment insurance, Medicaid, and other temporary help expands rather than reduces the deficit. That is simple kindergarten economics. And frankly, despite all the naysaying to the contrary, the recovery package was not as large as it was needed, but it helped turn the economy upward. And I played a major role in that, and I'm damn proud of it. It has helped turn the corner from losing 750,000 jobs each month at the end of the Bush presidency to four straight months of job growth since January. We also finally, after 70 years of trying, by Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, LBJ, Nixon, Clinton, and Obama, finally put the United States of America among the roll of civilized nations that provide the opportunity for almost all of their citizens to get the health care they need without begging. That legislation will finally put a leash on the ability of health insurance companies to practice blatant patient abuse. And it will open up the front door of doctors' offices and hospitals for 30 million Americans who until now had been locked out or relegated to the back door. I was in the chair presiding over the House when we passed that bill, and I'm proud of it, and I'm proud to be a Democrat. Yeah. It was, as Tammy Baldwin has reminded us, it was the Democratic Party that inherited this god-awful economic mess. It was the Democratic Party that produced every single social and economic advance in the past 70 years. It was the Democratic Party that finally broke through the line and delivered on health care, and it would not have happened without Nancy Pelosi's guts. It was the Republican Party that provided day in and day out obstruction and delay, misusing and abusing the misbegotten Senate rules. It was the GOP that provided not a single vote in the House for the economic recovery package. It was the GOP that provided not a single vote in the House for health care reform. No surprises there. 92% of House Republicans tried to kill Social Security in 1935, and 93% of House Republicans tried to kill Medicare 30 years later. They have had a lot of practice in being on the wrong side of history. The status quo that they want to preserve is a collection of economic policies that for six straight years under George Bush saw 94% of all of the income growth in America going to the pockets of the richest 10%. Shame, shame for allowing that perversion of capitalism that delivers platinum to the elite and table scraps to the multitudes. It is wrong economically, it is wrong morally. And we must stiffen the backbones of every Democrat who is tempted to go soft and temporize in pursuit of decency and justice. As I leave Congress and leave elected political life after 48 years and some 25 elections, I'm counting on you to pick up the torch. And I have one last thing to say. I've talked about the national challenges that confront us, but in my last speech to you, I want to return to where I started when I first ran for the State Assembly in 1962. The subject, the Wisconsin economy. This state is being killed by misguided and misdirected policies being promoted by Wisconsin's big business mouthpiece, the WMC, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association. That organization, by its nature, should be in the forefront of seeking bipartisan ways to strengthen Wisconsin's economy for the good of every Wisconsin family. But instead, since the departure of one of Wisconsin's wisest men, Paul Hassett, Wisconsin's economic policy has been pushed in the direction that has not just hurt working families, it has hurt Wisconsin business as well. Look at what has happened in the last 40 years. Since the late 60s, Wisconsin's big business lobby has insistently pushed policies that have shifted the burden of paying for public services from corporations to lower and middle income individuals. In 1969, when the Knowles administration pursued tax policies that increased income taxes on all but the very top bracket, my opponent at that time called it reasonable. I called it a rich man's tax plan. In the 70s, the big business lobby pushed for the M&E, machinery and equipment tax exemption, which shifted the tax burden from corporations to property taxpayers, and repeatedly the lobby for years has resisted adequate investments in education and health. The result? Wisconsin has become less like Wisconsin and more like our southern state neighbors. That's bad news, because with all due respect, Mississippi is not so much a state as it is a condition. and we do not want in any way to emulate that. And if you doubt me, look at the numbers. When I left the legislature in 1969, the per capita income in Wisconsin was $11,812. In Minnesota, it was $11,835, $23 higher. Today, Wisconsin's is $36,622, but Minnesota's is $41,552. That $23 gap has grown to a gap of $4,730 today. One huge reason for that, 31% of Minnesota residents graduate from college. But in Wisconsin, only 25% are college graduates. Another fact, when I left the legislature, 40% of the University of Wisconsin's operating budget came from the legislature. Today, that's less than 20%. Does anybody think those facts are not related? Wisconsin's big business lobby has systematically pushed to short-sheet virtually every investment Wisconsin makes, except tax cuts for corporations or the top tax rate for the most well-off individuals in this state. They have pursued at the state level the same set of economic policies being peddled by a few super-rich families and foundations at the national level, such as the Koch brothers, who brought us the Tea Parties, the Scafee Foundation, and many others. In Wisconsin, we need to remember, before Bob La Follette turned Wisconsin's politics right side up, state government was controlled lock, stock, and barrel by the railroads, the mining companies, and the timber companies. La Follette took it back, and for years, Wisconsin led the nation in pursuing enlightened government and enlightened capitalism. And that tradition was passed down through Schmiedeman, McGovern, Nelson, Reynolds, Lucy, Schreiber, Earle, and Doyle. And now we turn to Tom Barrett to pick up the challenge, and he will need your help. He is by nature a conciliator and a problem solver, but he also has steel. He's shown that in his public life. He showed it at the state fair last year. He will need it in the months and years ahead, and he will need you to be with him every step of the way. Public service is a high calling, but it is also a tough life. Tom Barrett and Barack Obama will need your help. We all have fun at conventions, but remember, the Democratic Party is not a social club. It is an organization of largely like-minded people with shared values and concerns who are willing to work like hell to make this a more prosperous, a stronger, and more enabling country for every person to reach his or her full potential as a human being, but who may, from time to time, need a little help. Very simply, I believe in the social gospel. I believe in America. I believe in Wisconsin. And most of the time, I believe in the Democratic Party. In spite of its sometimes maddening and frustrating faults, it is the only tool we've got to provide a better deal for regular working families. So I ask your help to nurture it, to strengthen it. Don't let little things split us apart, and carry on. Thank you much. And now, I'm not done yet. And now I ask you to listen to one more message with the cooperation of the sound folks in the back. And please listen to the words.
One man's stands there. We'll see that day come. eyes can't see the way ahead. Two men's eyes can't see. One man's voice can shout to make them hear. Two men's voices can shout to make them hear. But if two and two and 50 make a million, we'll see the day come round. We'll see.
Thank you. I love you all.
Let's hear it for Dave Obie.